From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. A new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation on youth incarceration rates finds the number of juveniles serving time in Florida went down 32% in the 15-year span between 1995 and 2010, and that this is part of a growing trend nationwide. We'll take a closer look at the report and what it reveals about the status of at-risk youth in Florida. Also, Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wensley Walters joins us to explore the department's stepped-up focus on preventing kids from entering the system in the first place. Plus, meeting the needs of domestic violence victims. We'll talk with Lucy Ortiz of the Shelter for Abused Women and Children's Immokalee Outreach Center about the unique challenges of helping domestic violence victims in the rural migrant community and about her recent attendance to the ceremony marking President Obama's signing of the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. First, this news. From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. In 2011, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement reports more than 113,000 domestic violence crimes were reported in the state, and experts say that's just a fraction of the actual number of crimes, as so many go unreported. Later in today's show, we'll talk with Lucy Ortiz of the Shelter for Abused Women and Children's Immokalee Outreach Center about her advocacy work on behalf of battered women, the history of the domestic violence movement, and the unique challenges of working with victims in a rural migrant community. That conversation's coming up later in today's show. But first, a new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation delivers positive news for Florida. The foundation's report on reducing youth violence in the U.S. finds that the number of juveniles serving time in Florida detention facilities dropped 32% between 1995 and 2010. Complementing that data snapshot, statistics from the State Department of Law Enforcement show across-the-board reductions in juvenile arrests for everything from delinquency arrests to more serious felony offenses. The Annie E. Casey report also comes on the heels of a new effort from the State Department of Law Enforcement announced last fall to reform juvenile justice in Florida, or rather the Department of Juvenile Justice, not the Department of Law Enforcement, with a greater focus on alternatives to detention. It's called the Roadmap to System Excellence Plan. Joining me now for a closer look at the report, Juvenile Justice Florida, is Bart Lubow. He's the director of the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Juvenile Justice Strategy Group. Bart, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also with us this morning is Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wensley Walters. She almost literally just got off of an airplane, or might still be on the airplane, so we're going to keep her on mute for just the moment, but she is here with us. And Secretary Walters, thanks so much for your time. Also with us is Stacey Gromatsky, President and CEO of the Florida Network of Youth and Family Services, which works with community partners around the state to address the needs of at-risk youth and their families. Stacey Gromatsky, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much.
I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. If you have a comment or question for our guests, give us a call. The phone number is 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Bart Lubow, let's begin with a look at what the Annie E. Casey Foundation's data snapshot reveals about juvenile justice in Florida. I mentioned earlier we've experienced a marked decrease in the number of incarcerated youth between 1995 and 2010. What had been the trend before that?
Well, the trends before that were actually a very steep run-up in the nation's use of incarceration, something that began both in juvenile and adult justice systems in the early 1970s. And by about 1995, 1997, we'd reached a peak, both in terms of the absolute numbers of kids who we locked up and in the rate at which we locked them up. And that was pretty consistent across all the states and reflected a trend that endured for well over 20 years.
And according to this report, as you'd alluded, 44 states experienced declines in juvenile detention rates. So can we fairly characterize this as a nationwide trend? I mean, what's behind this seeming paradigm shift?
Well, certainly our recent report was intended to highlight that there is a trend, even if it's a trend sort of flying under the radar. That is, changes in these kind of measures of juvenile justice system performance usually are revealed at the state level, and oftentimes the whole big national picture becomes less clear. And in fact, I think it's pretty fair to say that to a certain extent, the changes reflected in this national trend reflect a lot of idiosyncratic developments on a state-by-state basis, with some states experiencing budget crises that led them to cut back on things like detention or incarceration. Other states had lawsuits filed against their facilities, and that led to a reconsideration of policies. In other states, there was simply a sort of an advanced learning curve that said there are better ways that we can spend our money and achieve safety than by locking up 14, 15, or 16-year-olds. So the reasons are idiosyncratic, and there hasn't been yet the emergence of a clear national policy consensus that recognizes that juvenile corrections has a history of both being horribly expensive, frequently abusive and violent, and often ineffective in reducing recidivism.
Do you find it curious that this trend is happening, you know, across 44 states in the country? It's happening in every region of the United States, yet there seems to be no concerted national effort. Everybody's, as you said, going through their own situations, their own idiosyncratic context that's leading them towards the shift where we're incarcerating fewer and fewer juveniles.
Well, I find it interesting. I also find it encouraging. I think states are influenced by each other's trends, and so I think there is a certain amount of, if you will, peer-to-peer learning that occurs across states and professional gatherings and the like. I think there are certain parts of this trend that transcend state boundaries. We, for example, have operated for 20 years a national initiative designed to teach localities how to reduce their reliance on detention, on local confinement safely. That initiative now covers 39 states and almost 200 individual jurisdictions and is simply large enough to exert an influence that extends past individual county or state boundaries. So there are aspects of the trend that do reflect national movements, if not a national policy consensus. But we've operated in juvenile justice for quite a long period of time now without a lot of national leadership around juvenile justice activities. In fact, fortunately, the Obama administration just appointed an administrator for the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and that will hopefully result in a galvanizing of some of these trends and a more clearly articulated national perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, from an outsider's perspective, one might reason that locking up fewer juvenile offenders would mean, you know, Department of Juvenile Justice isn't properly dealing with kids with delinquent problems, and so that would lead to more juvenile crime. But as I mentioned earlier, that didn't really happen in Florida. What have other states that are reducing the number of youths in detention facilities experiencing in terms of crime levels among juveniles? Are they also seeing those reductions similar to what Florida is experiencing?
Yes, they are. And I think it's important to note that all of the people who are in positions like Secretary Walters begin their day by reaffirming their commitment to public safety first and foremost, without in any way diminishing their commitment to kids who are in trouble or who are troubling. So everybody is working towards a safer community as well as greater opportunities for the kids. The facts are that the states that had the sharpest reductions in the use of incarceration are also the states that had the sharpest reductions in juvenile crime. That's not to say that the answer to crime is to close all prisons. It is to say that the myth that if we reduced our reliance on incarceration, if we did a better job of ensuring that we locked up the right kids, but only the right kids, would produce improved public safety results. That if we let kids out, that we would somehow set off a juvenile crime wave. The goal is to make sure the right kids are confined, and if we do that, we will improve public safety at the same time that we reduce the number of kids who are behind bars and removed from their families.
And this, of course, isn't the first time the Annie E. Casey Foundation has looked into these issues. Your 2011 report, No Place for Kids, the case for reducing juvenile incarceration, really makes the case that putting inappropriate kids in juvenile justice facilities might actually be worse for them altogether. It might end up causing them to sort of have more, become more involved in the system, as opposed to getting into an alternative program earlier on, which they could then possibly avoid the justice system altogether.
All the research confirms that point and emphasizes that if we could do a better job of early intervention and do a better job of sorting the kids so that only those who pose really serious public safety risks are removed from their families and put in these institutions, the more likely we are to both have better public safety results and to help these kids get back on track.
And has the Annie E. Casey Foundation done much research into what sorts of alternatives to detention are working or would work effectively?
Well, we've done a lot of study of it and a lot of practical work, and we, of course, pay a lot of attention to what our colleagues throughout the country and in this field are doing by way of developing evidence about what works best with kids who get in trouble with the law.
And do you think we're going to be seeing larger numbers of these sorts of alternative programs coming on board across the country now with the rates of juvenile detention dropping?
I certainly hope so. I think it's a challenge to ensure that the money that's now going into corrections facilities gets reinvested into effective community-based programs. But I think that's the general direction and the policy shift that we're advocating and that many in the field, including, for example, Secretary Walters, are encouraging in their individual state policies.
We're talking with Bart Lubow of the Annie E. Casey Foundation about their recent report showing the juvenile incarceration rate in decline in Florida and across the country. Also with us is Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wensley Walters and Stacey Gromatsky of the Florida Network of Youth and Family Services. You can connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You may send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Secretary Walters, I wanted to turn to you now. The data for the Annie E. Casey Foundation report covers juvenile incarceration rates from the years from 1995 through 2010. And I know a lot can happen in just a couple years, but so have we seen this positive trend in fewer youth serving time continue since 2010?
Absolutely. We are continuing to see a reduction. As a matter of fact, in the past 2 years, we've seen almost 1,000 additional beds eliminated in our residential capacity, which is our deepest end. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we've been focusing on getting, as Bart mentioned, community-based programming into those communities in order to allow judges and prosecutors to have the confidence that the kind of services that this child might need is going to be available in the community. And, of course, we already know that keeping a child in his school, in his home, in his own community is going to be far, far better for that child than removing him and sending him away, because even if he does well in one of the programs, it is always going to be a challenge for him to re-enter back into his community.
And fittingly for this conversation, we are in National Youth Violence Prevention Week. In addition to fewer youth detentions, Florida is also experiencing a drop in juvenile arrests in categories ranging from delinquency arrests to more serious arrests for things like felony assault, car theft and armed robbery. In the last fiscal year, Florida's Juvenile Justice Department handled about 96,515 cases, down 34% from the 145,530 cases in 2007, in the fiscal year 2007-2008. And likewise, the number of arrests for manslaughter or murder decreased 49% over that same time period. And arrests on other felony counts dropped at rates from 18 to 50%. This is pretty dramatic. What do you think is behind these positive decreases? Do you think that these community-based programs you're talking about are working well here?
Well, I think they are, particularly if they are used in conjunction with an appropriate assessment to really get to the root cause of why a child might be behaving in such a manner or behaving in a criminal manner. Some of this, that has been significant in reducing the number of times a juvenile is arrested. And one of the other tools that we've been using in Florida is called civil citation, which allows us an opportunity for first-time misdemeanors to do those assessments, look at the root causes of why this child acted out, and really use that opportunity to provide services and encourage accountability, however, preventing that arrest record from moving forward, which really is key to that child's future, not having that arrest record. And we are finding that to be extraordinarily successful in that throughout the state, our data shows that 94% of the juveniles who commit first-time misdemeanors, these are cases that can be filed by a prosecutor, that by doing an assessment, getting them services, 94% of those children do not reoffend a year after the fact. And since this is also allowing us to really focus on keeping minority children out of the system, it's a significant tool in the state of Florida, and all of those things are contributing to the fewer children getting arrested here.
I did want to get into that those racial disparity issues a little bit later, but do you think that is all of this emphasis on really making sure that kids are getting into the right sort of treatment that they need, whether it's time in a detention facility, whether that's some sort of alternative program, is that really kind of at the foundation of the Department of Juvenile Justice's new Roadmap to System Excellence plan that was launched last fall?
That is exactly the main focus of where we're going, to allow us to stop a child in his track no matter where we find him coming into our system, to allow us to not put a child deeper in the system that needs to be, not use resources on a child that we don't need to use those resources, allowing us more resources for the children who do need additional treatment and help. And one of the things that, you know, in the old days of juvenile justice, when juveniles offended, we really addressed everything we did according to the level of offense. So it was a first-time misdemeanor for shoplifting, there would be pretty much a standard thing that would happen to all children. But we've since learned that you might have three shoplifters with three entirely different root causes. One child may not really need a lot of services and may have been just might have been normal adolescent misbehavior. You might have another child who's exhibiting drug issues and shoplifting in order to address those needs. You may have another child shoplifting because she's being abused at home, and that would entail an additional array of resources spent on that child. But what we have been finding, and I think this is standing true across the country, is that when you start to pay attention to what those causes are at the earliest possible point, you really do have a much better chance of preventing that child from coming back into the system or going deeper in the system.
And, you know, a lot of these, I imagine it all comes down to resources in the end, and you have a finite amount of money to put towards things. But with this reduced need for residential beds, I imagine that's coming at a cost savings. How is the DJJ reallocating that money?
Well, in the governor's budget this year, we are reinvesting and expanding prevention services. We're also retooling a lot of our existing funding and programming. When you take into consideration that a 24-bed facility costs between $1.5 and $2 million, without the need for those 24 beds, you can imagine what that money can purchase at a community level in the prevention arena. So we're looking forward to really reinvesting our resources. And one of the providers of prevention services and shelters is going to be expanding those services into areas of Florida that doesn't have those services right now.
And we've touched on this a bit, but, you know, for some youth offenders, do you think serving time in a detention facility is actually counterproductive for them and for society? How do we identify those kids, and what sorts of alternatives to detention are making an impact in Florida? And Stacey Gromadsky with the Florida Network, I know you're, the partner organizations you work with are primarily working with proactive, you know, kids who are not quite in the system yet. But if any of the agencies you work with are part of these alternative programs, please weigh in on that question as well.
Well, I mean, we're really thrilled at the opportunity to be able to be partners with the department in finding these youth that we know through research and data shows us that they're very likely to end up in the system. But if we get them early through our targeting efforts, that 90% of our kids will go on to be crime-free and to return to their homes and remain in their schools. And the interesting thing about the youth that our program serves throughout the state of Florida is that when you look at the characteristics and the risk factors of those youth, they line up exactly with those youth that are in commitment. So we know that these youth without services are going to probably end up in residential commitment programs without the services early on.
And tell us just a little bit more about the Florida Network for listeners who might not be terribly familiar with the organization.
Well, we're a statewide association of youth crisis organizations, the majority of which offer youth shelter programs for kids from the ages of 10 through 17 who are experiencing some kind of crisis in the home. In the southwest area of Florida, we have Lutheran Services of Florida Oasis Shelter in Fort Myers, the YMCA shelter in Sarasota, and Family Resources offers Safe Place to Be shelter in Bradenton. And what those programs do, as I mentioned, is they target those kids who we know are having difficulty in school, having difficulty with their peers, not obeying their parents, or having difficulty in the home. And they are referred to us, and we're able to offer non-residential counseling or shelter services that are geared at working on what those problems are that are causing those behavior issues, so that we can then avoid future involvement in either the delinquency or the dependency system.
It was interesting looking on the Florida Network's website. There was a draft data profile of partner agencies, really breaking down the different reasons that youth or their families seek help. And for fiscal year 2009 and 2010, it indicates that an overwhelming 84.6% sought help for problems with family dynamics. School and education issues was an issue or a problem for 74.5%. And actual involvement with the juvenile justice system accounted for 32.3% of clients. So, of course, you know, that's more than a quarter, but certainly far less than the 85% who were talking about family dynamic issues. So it's interesting that so many of the kids that you're helping out haven't really even touched the juvenile justice system yet, but you just see the potential risk there.
Well, I would have to say that most of our providers say they just haven't got caught yet.
Yeah, right.
Or, you know, the idea that, you know, hopefully there are resources that have been working with them to try and prevent that arrest through the use of civil citations, or even after initial arrest, trying to get them to some services like Florida Network agencies early on. And the other thing that is new that we're doing, and we're very grateful to the governor and Secretary Walters for entrusting us with this, is to serve those youth who have been arrested for domestic violence. In the past, they would have gone directly to detention. But for those youth who are arrested for domestic violence based on family issues or difficulty in their home, those youth can now come to our shelters, which are more family-based, they're in their community, they're more home-like, and they're, you know, addressing their very specific needs than in a detention facility. And we're really excited about this new project that just started in February.
All right. And is the Florida Network now, you kind of mentioned this program, are you looking to grow the number of partner agencies within the Florida Network? And is there really a demonstrable need for more financial resources for these preventative programs here in Florida?
Yes, there absolutely is. We're operating on a waiting list at each of our programs for about 125 kids a month. And that's for shelter services. We don't get calls for shelter services unless there's a true emergency. We also have numerous counties throughout the state who have no resources in their communities and would have to drive to maybe two counties over to get services. And clearly that's not a great likely to happen, especially since the families oftentimes are poor, difficulty with working two jobs and not being able to bring their kids into shelter. So Governor Scott has agreed with us and is recommending to the legislature that we be able to expand services in those underserved communities.
And Secretary Walters, an ongoing issue, not just here in Florida, but around the nation, is the racial disparity in youths who wind up in the DJJ system. And you did touch on this a bit earlier. But a previous report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation found that when white kids and African-American kids with no prior record were charged with the same offense, African-American youth are five times more likely to be incarcerated than their white counterparts. Is this something of a, I mean, that's a national statistic, but is that something of a problem in Florida as well?
Absolutely. There's no question that minority children are overrepresented in every category in the juvenile justice system. And we're really doing everything that we can come up with to try to address it. From working with law enforcement, we're working very hard to get additional juvenile justice training in the core training that is provided to law enforcement officers so that officers can begin to understand brain development and cultural distinctions so that possibly they can de-escalate some aggression on the part of certain children who may react to them in a different way. We've also been going around the state having focus groups with groups of students and law enforcement officers where they can really talk together, and some very interesting conversations have taken place. As we've gone around with our taking our roadmap to systems excellence around to the different communities in the state of Florida, our prevention people have also been conducting these type of focus groups. We're also looking to work with schools, a lot more work in the schools. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I'm just coming back into Tallahassee is because there is a national group that is working with the Council for State Governments on school discipline and keeping children out of the justice center. System so that national policy can be developed and consensus on how we need to move in that direction. And certainly we have far too many children arrested in our schools who are not even really being charged with fileable offenses. They're being charged for behavior problems. And even if those cases are not filed in the state of Florida, that child still has an arrest record. And I think we can do much better. And we are trying to engage at every level people to work with us on this. One final area that we're working on is really getting developing in family engagement, because we need parents to work with the schools and tell them that a different type of approach needs to be taken with children, because there are what we are seeing is that some schools rely on this as disciplinary tools, and other schools would never rely on arrest for a disciplinary tool. And a lot of that has to do with the parents at working with those schools.
I would wonder if Florida's zero tolerance policy also plays a role there. And I bring this up There was a reporter from the State Impact Florida journalism team here that was really investigate education issues and highlighting one Broward County student's unfortunate experience. And in the story, as a seventh grader, the student, he's now 17, but when he was in seventh grade, got into an altercation on a school bus with a friend, hit the friend over the head with a lollipop, a Tootsie Pop. And because that incident happened on a school bus, he was arrested and charged with misdemeanor battery. And the battery charge, you know, as you had alluded to before, it's going to follow him for the rest of his life. Would you support efforts? We're in the legislative session now to maybe replace that zero tolerance policy with perhaps something less stringent that gives schools, I guess, more say in whether or not to make an arrest.
Well, in fact, we have Florida law has been moving away from zero tolerance, and I can give you so many stories very similar to the one that you described in Broward of children doing virtually nothing, and because of this policy, children were being arrested, and it's very damaging. I mean, it for those of us who work in the field of juvenile justice, it is heartbreaking to think how this system has damaged the lives of so many children.
Well, and I brought it up because I did see that there was a bill in the legislature moving its way through now that it looks like it would loosen some of those zero tolerance policy restrictions. And I'm sure you're watching the state legislative session. Are there any proposals that you're watching closely now, or what's on the department's agenda for this session?
Well, the department's agenda is supporting the governor's budget and ensuring that we are able to shift some of our savings to the front end of our system. We do have some legislation that adds further protections for children. For example, a child who, we're proposing a law change that anyone in one of our facilities, even after turning the age of 18, would still enjoy child abuse protections, which does not happen now if the child turns 18. We're also have some legislation that is going to strengthen our ability to connect to local communities and have more of a voice and a collaborative relationship. But more than anything, what's heartening in the legislature this year is to see how many legislators are aware of juvenile justice reform, that we have a roadmap that is in draft form and being contributed to by people all over the state, all of our stakeholders, and that is establishing the foundation for us to move into the next legislative session next year with a complete rewrite of the Florida statute so that we can ensure that Florida law has the best practice in the field of juvenile justice and that we have a system that protects children, protects their future and their spirits, and really gives the state a system it can be proud of.
And Secretary Walters, I know you've been traveling the state, touring detention facilities and holding town hall style meetings with stakeholders and members of the public, really just to give people more information about this roadmap to system excellence that won't be coming to Lee County where we are until after the legislative session. But what kind of response have you been getting?
It has been incredible, the positive response that we are getting around the state. I mean, I certainly hoped for that kind of response, but I think we have all been amazed by it. People really are coming out to these town hall meetings, and we're also meeting with stakeholders, judges, law enforcement, state attorneys, public defenders, school systems, to really see what we can all do collectively to have a better juvenile justice system. And so much of what is going to make it the best type of juvenile justice system is that it is a very local, driven by local leadership, so that people in that community really own that system and want to serve those children, their children, in the best way.
Well, thank you. That is all the time we have for this portion of the show, but I want to thank my guests, Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Wansley Walters. Thanks for joining us this morning.
thank you so much for having this.
And Stacey Gromatsky is president and CEO of the Florida Network of Youth and Family Services. Thanks for your time this morning as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And Bart Lubau, director of the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Juvenile Justice Strategy Group. Thank you also for joining us.
You're very welcome.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, Lucy Ortiz of the Shelter for Abused Women and Children's Immokalee Outreach Center joins us for a look at some of the unique challenges of working with battered women in a rural, largely migrant community, and for a look at the history of the domestic violence movement. She recently attended President Obama's signing of the Reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us.